accession number 9434, reel 8.
Mr. Bill Collins, reel 8. I'd like to look at a couple of points that came up during that story. The first is about the gas. You say that the gas... What sort of gas was it in the first place?
It was chlorine. Chlorine gas. Dirty green cloud.
And you say this was attracted by the water of Zillebeck Lake. Was
yes.
this a common phenomenon, an accepted phenomenon?
An accepted phenomenon, yes. And of course, the low-lying Menin Road.
And how much gas were you actually subjected to at this point in the convent? Did you get a lot of gas?
Quite a lot. By the time we left the convent to go up again to Sanctuary Wood in the evening, it was still thick there. The gas cloud was heavy, you know, and I must tell you that about midday that day, the supplies of the first so-called gas mask came up, and all it consisted of was a pad, a wool covered by gauze, with an elastic band running right round, and about the size of what I'm showing you now.
About four inches by two.
It fitted over the nose, nostrils and mouth, and the elastic went up over the head. But I found in using it in the gas cloud that after a couple of minutes one couldn't breathe. And so it was pushed up over the forehead like that, and we swallowed the gas. And could only put the thing back again for very short periods. It was not a practical proposition at all, but it was something, and I suppose we ought to have felt grateful. But another thing they issued us with, which was not very practical either, was they issued us with a sprayer at the aid post there, a sprayer and some cans of photographic hypo, and the idea was to spray the air with this solution and disperse the gas, but it didn't work as far as we were concerned, and we stopped using it.
Did you know what this sprayer was called? Was it the Vermeil?
I don't know what it was called, but it was a nozzle sprayer. You the water was in the can, and you pressed a button or did something and sprayed it. Matter of fact, I didn't pay much attention because it didn't disperse the gas.
What symptoms did you suffer at this point through breathing in the gas?
You got dryness of the mouth and throat and nose when we pushed the thing up over our head. And breathe the gas in. You began to get dry on the nose and throat, and the eyes began to smart. You see, so I put it. We used to put them straight back again, and stick it as long as we could before we went. But once we cleared Hellfire Corner and got up to
this is on that night's mission.
Past the Billy Pond.
That was when you went on the mission.
Past Zillebeck Lake, got past there, and up met the rise up to Sanctuary Wood. The gas cloud had disappeared. It was all down in that very heavily concentrated on the Menin Road and the area around Zillebeck and the lake. You see. Now, I must tell you, during that day, we had motor ambulances. We used to have a couple of motor ambulances coming up through Ypres and to collect casualties to take them from the aid post, because the road was still good there, you see. And although Ypres was cluttered with dead horses and limbers, there was always a way through, and they came up to collect them. Now, on that day, the gas came over. We'd filled a motor ambulance with casualties, all sitting cases. We filled one with sitting cases, all bandaged and everything, and we were just ready to go off when a shell burst close by, a heavy shell, and everyone ducked. And when we got up again, you know, got our heads down. When we got up, straightened up again, the pieces of the shell had ripped through the side of the motor ambulance, It was only a canvas cover, you know. It ripped through the canvas side and had wounded four men again that were sitting in there already waiting to be transferred to our headquarters of the field ambulance. And so there was a case of four men bandaged and everything all ready to be evacuated, and they were wounded again sitting in the ambulance. That, I think, is the most unlucky thing for to happen to a man. But we had to do them, bring up, take them out, do their wounds, put them back in again, and of course they were just got to save any other chance. They were pushed off straight away out of it and down to Ypres. But that was the most extraordinary happening.
These motor ambulances, you had two or three of these.
We had a couple.
But the ones normally
were working. But normally the ambulance only had one. The equipment of the our cavalry field ambulance was one Austin motor ambulance. But we had two working on this occasion on the on this particular post.
What happened next then after that night's mission?
Well, after the gas attack that day? After the gas attack that day, I went up as usual, and but before I went up, Captain Osborne, Rex Osborne, he was brigade major of the 1st Cavalry Brigade. He came out and saw me and he said, Sergeant, he said, you're going up the line, aren't you? He knew I went up every night. They knew everything had happened. I said, yes, sir. He said, well, he said, find Colonel Pittman and tell him he will be relieved at about 9 o'clock tonight. So I said, yes. So I went, I set off through the gas cloud up to Sanctuary Wood, and when I got there, as soon as I tried to get into the wood, I had a bayonet at my throat. A bayonet was stuck there right at my throat. It was a very alert sentry, and I noticed then that the wood, the floor of the wood, there were stretcher cases and cases without stretchers, you know, all casualties. They were lying all over the floor of the wood because there'd been a very heavy fight there that day, up in the wood. The Germans had attacked, but the attack had been repulsed and beaten off. And there were the casualties there. But I found Colonel Pittman. He was with Captain Wagstaff, the medical officer, in his hut. And I told him that I had a message from Captain Osborne. You will be relieved at about 9 o'clock tonight. And he said, give him a drink. He turned to Captain Wagstaff, give him a drink. And he went off straight away to tell the regiments that they were going to be relieved, because by then it was half past seven, 7:15.
On a case like this, when there are a lot of casualties, how would you cope with them in your ambulance? Because it could only take it.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'll tell you what happened. I used our ambulances to the full, but after I got the first lot full and we went down on a little side road which led off round. In the direction of Hooge, off the track, there was a little side track which led off. I noticed a line of motor cars drawn up. And I stopped, and I walked up to the... I looked at them, and I noticed they were fitted with two receptacles inside to take a stretcher. You know, there were slides, a couple of slides. And you know what they were? They were the early Ford motor cars. They were the first Ford, the Flippers. And they had been fitted out to take two stretcher cases, and there were about a dozen of these, I suppose, must have been quite a dozen of these motor cars. They're on the side road, waiting to go up in, you see. And anyway, I told the officer commanding, I said, you'll find the tracks quite all right for your motor cars. It's firm and solid, and you can turn around. The ground up there is quite firm. You've got no troubles with regard to turning. He says, thank you very much. And I think they were the people who cleared the rest of the casualties. But fancy the old Ford Flivver being used as motor ambulances. That was the first time I should think that an ordinary motor car had its innards torn out and a couple of slides put in to take two stretcher cases.
What would have happened if you hadn't met these people?
Kept going backwards and forwards until they were cleared.
Now, you'd been in this gas all day before that night. What effects did it have on you both then and now? You said you had a dry throat, but did it have any more of an impact on you?
Not immediately. You see, I was young, and I had a good chest. I was a 43 chest, and my breathing was perfect, and not immediately, but it was after the war, when it was all over, I began to feel it. You know, it began to get at me a little bit then. No, I never felt it again during the war.
In what way did it get at you after the war?
Well, coughs and colds, you know, coughs and colds I used to get a lot of yellow sputum, see, until I got treatment for it, you see. And in any case, later on in my life, in 1953, when I was a director of a company, we all went down, we all had the motor van test, you know, for the lungs, and they wouldn't pass me. I had to go down to the x-ray department at Tooting, where they took a large x-ray photograph of me, and called me back again and said, "We're very worried about you." So I said, "Well, what's you worried?" "Is it my left lung?" She said, "Yes." I had badly gassed in 1915. "Oh," she said, "that's what it is." We couldn't make out what it was, but there was something very badly wrong with it, you see. So I've lived all this time, whether it's with it, and I've had plenty of trouble until I found out how to cope with it, you see. And I gargle and keep my throat clear night and morning, and I don't mix with people. I live right away from people. I only mix with people in the supermarkets or when I travel, and so I'm not liable to catch germs from anybody else. And I haven't got any myself, so I'm managing to get on, you know, without it, you see.
What about the patients, you know, who were also on the ground, a lot of them, I suppose, and they were in, were they badly hit by the gas?
Well, yeah, they had the very worst cases I saw were exuding. Liquid from their mouth, you know, the gas had got into their lungs, and it was watering, coming out in water. Nasty looking cases they were.
These are people brought back from the front line.
Yeah, not from our front line, because you see, we didn't get the gas up in Sanctuary Wood. These are the people who came up from down from Hooge, see, we were the nearest aid post to Hooge. And everybody came to our place, you see.
Would they recover from a gas, from something like that?
I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you, because it would depend on the amount of damage to the lungs, you see.
What treatment would you give them?
Nothing. Couldn't do anything. We couldn't do anything.
What about all your patients, the people who've been wounded and such like? Did they suffer more from the gas than you did, being unable to protect themselves quite as well?
No,
On ground level?
No, you see, the patients from Sanctuary Wood hadn't been affected by the gas, because they were above the gas. They were higher. They were up there on the top of the.
I mean, when they were lying in your aid post.
They weren't affected there, because you see, as I say, we had the gas till 8 o'clock that night, or 9 o'clock that night. But later. When I came, the last ambulance came down from Sanctuary Wood, there was still gas hanging around, and that would be about 2 o'clock in the morning, but not in such a heavy concentration, you see. It had begun to thin out then. And I never saw it. If they were affected by it, we hadn't got time to bother, you see. We were bandaging, treating, getting them away out of the area as soon as possible.
Did it affect any of your comrades badly, the gas, worse than you, or did they all
they all managed. That we all got much about the same proportion of it, but none of them ever complained. They all worked on.
But even though it was fairly thick in this area, it still was nowhere near as thick as in the front line.
No, it was thicker. It wasn't as dense as it would be up in Hooge itself, or where. But you see, as it travelled, it was bound to thin and thin a little bit. But it was quite bad, I can tell you, because I just had to put that stuff over my mouth every two or three minutes to get a chance, you see, and then take a chance with breathing it in, but if I'd continued breathing it in, I should have been a casualty myself. But this little contraption, although it was not very useful, it did at least stop some of the gas from getting in.
So it may well have said it was useful, even if it wasn't perfect.
It was useful, yeah.
What about the horses? What was done for them?
Well, they had gas masks too, you know. They sent up some masks for the horses. But we put them on, but I noticed that the horses were not affected in the slightest. They didn't, the gas didn't affect them in the slightest. They kept their heads up. There was no trouble. They didn't walk sluggishly. They carried on just the same as usual.
So after this night, when you'd had the four flivvers help you out, what happened the next day?
Well, the next day, that was the night I took up the message.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, that was the last time. Next day we left the position because they'd been relieved. You see, the cavalry composite battalion had been relieved at 9 o'clock that night. As a matter of fact, I stood up there at Sanctuary Wood while they filed past, going out to rest, you see. I stood by until they'd all finished piling up.
What impression did you have of the condition of the composite regiment then?
Very good. Oh, they were very good. Very good. Mind you, we've got to remember these were elite troops. They were elite troops, the cavalry. I mean, they were good, fine physicals. A lot of regulars still among them, you see. Quite a number of regulars. Mind you, By June, a lot of them had suffered, but there was still a large proportion of regulars among them, and they were a very fine crowd, physically.
Talking about this, were they the equal of the infantry regulars? Did they have the same fighting skills for trench warfare?
Yeah, I should think they would be equals and superior to many, because, you see, they had the physique, and they had the training. They could fight on foot or on horseback. Yeah, absolutely. And you see, I mean, they had the strength.
So they'd be able to match the regulars and things like rifle shooting?
Oh, even better, because, I mean, they were all good shots, crack shots. Oh, they were very, the cavalry were a highly trained force, very highly trained.
And as they filed past you, you got the impression that all was well with the morale of the unit.
Oh, absolutely. Matter of fact, there were a couple of them were wounded as they filed past by these stray bullets, you see. And the others were pulling their legs, saying, "You lucky so-and-so," you know. Pulling their legs and laughing.
Where did you go back to then?
Well, when we came out, we went back to a place about, I suppose, 4 miles behind the line. And I must tell you, at this stage, that we were as lousy as coots. The fleas were absolutely unbearable. Ypres was absolutely a reservoir of fleas. And I was bitten, every inch of my body was bitten, flea bites. You see? And as I lay down the first night we were out of the line, I was hitching and tossing and itching before we could get away to the baths and get a bath and a change of underwear, you see. But, you know, we weren't alone. The Germans were just as cooty. Because I remember later in the war, when we passed at Arras, we passed a door outside Arras, and on it was the word Entlausung, which is German for delousing station. So they were just as cooty as we were.
During this, you know, this was the first time you'd had lice. What did you know what to do? Did you know how to try and get rid of them? Did you have any methods you used to try and keep them down?
Well, we used to get supplies of Keating's powder, you know, which is a prominent specific for lice and insects of all kind in the Victorian and Edwardian and those days. But you know, it wasn't very effective. In fact, the soldiers used to joke that after having a meal of fresh meat from us, Keating's was the dessert for the fleas.
Did you try and catch the fleas with your fingers or burn them? Or what methods did you do anything like that?
Oh yes, we used to strip out when we came out of Ypres. and 5 miles or so behind the line, we stripped, took off our shirts, and we used to run a lighted match down the seams of the shirts where all the fleas were, and burn them, anything, all sorts of things like that. We used to try to kill them, you see, but they were too numerous for us.
Was that a skill you developed? Because I can imagine you could have a little bit of a problem.
Oh, yes.
With a lighted...
Lighted, yeah. It was a skill we developed. You see, we just fit the match and went quickly down, and they were crack, 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 crack. You could hear the crackle as we were burning them down the sleeve. They were used to congregate in the seams of the shirts and vests.
So they'd go crack before the cotton caught fire.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, we went down very quickly, you see. We didn't take a chance of burning the garment.
Well, you said you had other methods. Can you remember any of the other methods?
Of
delousing?
Of delousing? No, I don't think there was anything else we could do except to wash, you know, bath. If we were in a... got to a place where there's a woman who would cooperate. We got her to run a hot iron down the seam, you know, a hot iron, and that would kill them, you see.
But all of this was temporary.
Always temporary, yes. Later on, by the time we got to 1916, I'd got clear of the fleas, and a good many other people had too. And I was never troubled with them again throughout the rest of the war.
How did you get clear of them?
I don't know. Just by getting washing as often as possible and getting to the bars and getting the clean shirts as often as possible.
Now, you pulled back about 5 miles behind the line, you said.
Yeah.
Round about it would be the 4th or 5th of May. Yeah. Where did you... Do you know where exactly you went back to?
Yes, we went back into the line at Ypres again.
No, I mean when you went out to rest.
I couldn't... It was on a flat bit of ground. Oh, I can't remember it now, but it was not very far behind. But we... of course, we'd only been out a few days when we went back again.
Right.
We went back to... whereas in Sanctuary Wood we'd been on the right side of the Menin Road, we went back to in action to the left side of the Menin Road. When the cavalry were occupying some of the trenches where the Canadians had been in action in the first gas attack, you see. And the exact name of the place where we landed up was Potige, Potyzde. It's a Belgian Flemish name. And immediately up in front of Potige, there was a slight rise away out of Potige, and was the Friesenberg Ridge, where the cavalry trenches were. You see, and. Friesenberg Ridge, and on the 13th of May, which is not long after the gas attack of the 3rd, on the 13th of May, the Germans turned every bit of high explosive they could lay their hands of onto the unfortunate cavalrymen holding those trenches up in that Friesenberg Ridge. And they blew them in, caused a lot of casualties, blew them in. They had to retire out of those trenches, go back a little bit and dig a French line, because their trenches were literally obliterated. Literally a high explosive. It was the first real heavy high explosive attack that we'd experienced.
So this was now high explosive at ground level,
as ground level, as exposed to high bursts. This was a ground level burst, and it blew their line to bits.
Now, where was your advanced post?
My advanced post was just below Potige, on a side road, and at night time I used to move up to Potige, where there was a chateau, a whitish-coloured chateau, and underneath the chateau a very large cellar, and that cellar was used as a dressing station, you know, as an aid post. And it was full, never empty. The medical officer with me, when we pulled the two ambulances up outside it, he went into the dressing station there, and I never saw him for two or three. He'd been there with his coat off, bandaging and operating and doing all sorts of things there, you see, because the casualties had more or less ceased coming down. We'd got them all down, and at least we thought we had. And he said, "Stand by and wait." He says, "And see, wait for further orders." So I stood outside Potty's dressing station, and very soon a group of men came down and said they thought there were some casualties up on the hill. You see, so. Funny thing, I turned round and I saw they got some stretchers, and I saw the ADMS, that's the Assistant Director of Medical Services, for the whole of the Cavalry Division, standing there, and he turned to me and he says, "Sergeant," he says, "you go with them." And so I went up with these people. We went up the hill, up to the top of the hill, where the Friesenberg Ridge is, and when we got to the top, there was a man supposed to be guide. And he said to me, he says, I don't know exactly where the line is, but he says, we'll have to go and find it. Well, now, by then, it was dark. By then, it was about 8 o'clock. By then, the Veery lights were going up, and they seemed to be going up almost, in front of me, the German Veery lights. So anyway, he said, look, he says, we'll have to crawl the rest. So we crawl the rest of the way, kept crawling until we came to a trench where a man was shoveling up the dirt, and we had to take a chance on what it was. So I leaned over the back of the trench, and I got close to the spade, and I whispered down to the man, I whispered down, and I said, who are you? He said, 11th Hussars. And then I knew that was our brigade, you see. So I said, have you got any casualties here, any at all? Because we got some stretchers and a party. He says, no, none in this sector. He says, none of here at all. So I thought, all right. So we went back, and I sent the party lower down the valley and to get on with it, because I was in charge of those ambulances. If I had left them and gone away, and my office, medical officer had come out and said, where are you? Are you going to put me on a charge for deserting my post up? It's a very bad situation for me to be in, you see. So I decided to send them on, and I walked back again down to the Chateau of Potage. Now, when I left that trench, after crawling up to that trench, when I got onto the road again, a stretcher party came by with four men carrying a stretcher. And I said to them, are you all right? Can I help you? And I said, I'm a sergeant at the Royal Army Medical Corps. They said, no, you can't help this man. He said, he's dead. I said, oh. He said, who is he? And he said, Captain the Honourable Stephen Freeman Mitford, 10th Hussars. That's a unit in Mitford's, probably uncle, I should think.